Our subject for this evening is the theological distinctives of the Presbyterian Reformed Church. That may seem, on the one hand, esoteric, and on the other hand, partisan. And we will try not to fall into either of those mistakes. What these distinctives are the doctrines that people have held over the years. They identify who we are. When this set of doctrines comes together and the boxes are ticked, it describes us. It's where we stand on the theological spectrum. It's where we are in the list of Reformed churches. So I'm going to speak about seven headings that would describe our distinctives. A distinctive is a distinguishing mark. These are our moles and scars, the colour of our hair, colour of our eyes, shape of our face, our build. If someone were looking for us, these are the things that would be announced on the radio, followed by, if you see this person, do not approach them. So, these are the things that mark us out. And the first one I want to speak about is indigenization without assimilation. It's a little bit long to put on a flag. You know, taxation without representation. No taxation without representation is a little bit pithier. But this is where we are. Indigenization without assimilation. What does that mean? What does indigenization mean? Indigenization in this context means belonging to a place and a people. The reformers started out with the idea of national churches. And when in the 19th century, the Free Church of Scotland came out of the Church of Scotland. There were many Church of Scotland congregations in England. But instead of having the Free Church of Scotland in England, what they did was they created the Presbyterian Church of England. They followed the same model in the colonies as the colonies grew and as they obtained a greater degree of self-determination, they started churches, independent churches, churches independent of the mother country, in the colonies once they were financially self-sufficient. That happened in Canada, and we'll hear a little bit more of that later. It happened in Australia, it happened in New Zealand. That was the approach that was taken. So indigenization means a church in a place run by the people of that place independently of the mother church. It's one of these strange things where a daughter church becomes a sister church, and that's the pattern of indigenization we're speaking of. But this is indigenization without assimilation. There is the culture, the religious culture of the place. There is the way that things are done. And what we have in the Presbyterian Reformed Church from our history is that we have indigenization cutting the colonial cord, but we don't have assimilation into the general pattern of the country or countries that we're in. And we'll see a little bit about that in a moment. So that's indigenization without assimilation. I'll show you how that works in a minute or two. But first of all, we have to think in this of labels and principles. And that's where things become difficult. Labels and principles. Because this is to quote Brian Myers when we were just talking about what he was going to say and what I was going to say. That was before he left me his list last night. He said, "Oh good, you get to do the alphabet soup." And I thought, why me? But I'm afraid I have the alphabet soup to do. Labels and principles. Let's talk about labels. Are we Covenanter? Are we secession? Are we free church? And the answer to that is yes. Because as the congregations came together to be the Presbyterian Reformed Church, all of these backgrounds were there. But not one of them completely wins through. With regard to the Chesley congregation, the Chesley congregation began its connected ecclesiastical life in the United Presbyterian Church of, I think it was North America at that time, its name was, United Presbyterian Church. The congregation was in it for a while, and as we heard, there was trouble within the congregation, and the congregation, because it did not respond to presbytery injunction, was suspended from the denomination. A little while later, they realized that they couldn't stand in that position, and so they made their peace with the United Presbyterian Church. But as they did that, they got their standing back, and not long after that, they transferred to the Associate Presbyterian Church. Then after that, they joined the Free Presbyterian Church of Scotland. After Mr. Matheson's protest, they became the Free Presbyterian Church of Ontario, and then they became the Presbyterian Reformed Church. The church in Toronto started out as a congregation in the Canadian Presbyterian Church. That was a coming together of the Free Church and the Scottish United Presbyterians in Canada. They were in that for a while, and then they left it. And they joined the Reformed Presbyterian Church of Pittsburgh and Ontario. Then they were on their own for a considerable number of years, unaffiliated, and then came into the Presbyterian Reformed Church. There's another group of churches, and my point this evening is that they are extremely important to understand who we are. None of them are still in the denomination because the people died out. They were in small farming communities. The churches were on crossroads that were equally inaccessible to all. They were not in towns, they were in farming areas, they were built on a gifted corner of a field. And the church in Lochalsh was such the church in East Williams was such, and the churches further south in Huron County were such. And they started out in the Church of Scotland. They came out of the Church of Scotland in 1844. They were in the Free Church of Scotland until the 1860s, and they objected to the union between the Free Church congregations and the United Presbyterian Church of Scotland congregations, and so they didn't go into the union. And they were unaffiliated, and their problem was that they had no one after their original pastors passed away. They were bereft. And they were the ones who originally got together and asked to come into the Free Presbyterian Church of Scotland, and Chesley followed suit. But they were, in the very early days, still part of the PRC, because Chesley Lough Alsh was the name of the congregation that I pastor until very recently. And they still used to go down to keep a claim. The church in East Williams was such a quaint little country church of the time that it was picked up, travelled along the roads, and put into a pioneer village outside of London, Ontario. And it's the church in that pioneer village. And to maintain the illusion of ownership, the congregation used to go down and take a service in that church once every year, because you know, we had gifted the building to them. It wasn't theirs. So that was still what was done for a number of years, though I think the practice fell out of mode in the 70s. So there's an awful lot of alphabet soup here. There's a lot of denominations mentioned here. And as we go back, we say, well, Covenanter, Secession, Free Church. The thing that marks all of these congregations out is this, that they were all part of churches that severed their tie in the 19th century from Scotland. But they were all congregations who sought out denominations that were not changing into North American style churches. We think that modern style churches are a thing that we're looking at in this day and age. And you're saying, well, we don't want to be part of this great program system church. We don't want to be part of the multi-ring circus church. You know, if you get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, you can go to the traditional service, knowing that the youth of today will not get up. You have the jazz or the rock service. Well, the jazz service will be about 10. And then the rock service will be at 12, because they might have got out of their beds by then. You've not got that range of things in the 19th century, but you still have change. And the change is coming culturally, the change is coming theologically, the change is coming in worship. There's Psalms, and then there's Watts imitation Psalms, and then there's paraphrases, and then there's this kind of hymn, and there's that kind of hymn, and then, you know, exclusive psalmody and Christmas isn't all that easy to do, so then we need some more hymns. And over the 19th century, that's the way things are changing. And the other thing that comes along is, well, we've got a presenter. Yes. But, you know, a harmonium would do quite nicely. And then we get a little bit more affluent. And one of the things about affluence is that affluence always wants you to ape your social betters. And the social betters in the culture were the Episcopalians. And so they've got an organ. And they call the parts of their church by strange names. So we're going to start calling the parts of our church by strange names. And then we're going to have an organ. And because of that, we have to move things around. So that people can see all our nice pipes, we're going to move the pulpit over to the side. And before you know where you are, you've got all these changes have come in to Presbyterian churches. And the theology of church building is gone. And a new theology and a new language, which is basically sacerdotal, starts to come in. I'm probably going to ruin things for you, but every time somebody says sanctuary, I always think of Charles Lawton hanging off the walls of Notre Dame Cathedral. We do not have a sanctuary in our buildings. We don't have, I hope, chancels. We don't have these things because that doesn't belong to our theology. But these things were coming in and they were seen as being nice, and that was a major difficulty. And what happened was that the congregations that eventually became the PRC and influenced its being were ones who stood back and said, no. The pulpit goes front and centre on the wall. And it doesn't have to be facing east-west. It just goes on the wall. And the whole point about it is not its architecture, but the fact that someone can stand in it and be heard throughout the room. That's the point. We don't have the layout of these new developing churches, the new buildings. You know, when they've moved from the wood sideboard, you know, the board building that they had, and they've started to build in brick or stone. It's around that time that these changes are coming. And our people stood out from that. They stood in the old ways, psalmody, no instrumental music, simplicity in the worship service. That was part of it. And we come through with that. But indigenization without assimilation, without changing and adopting the current national ecclesiastical flow and culture, that's where we start. But then doing that, staying in the old paths, brings something, our next heading, and that is Psalms and isolation. Psalms and isolation. Because the big denominations are now saying, you're allowed to do this. If you want to have an organ, you can have an organ. If you want to have hymns, you can have hymns. If you want to do this, you can do this. You don't have to. But it doesn't take long for that allowance to become the norm. And then the thing that was allowed becoming the norm then becomes the thing that is demanded. So what happens is these congregations become more and more isolated. They're having difficulty finding groups to be part of. The next thing that goes along with that isolation is the fact that they are actually physically isolated. And one of the things that runs through this whole story is the cry for supply. We can't get preaching. We can't get ministers. And when these congregations come together to approach a denomination, what they're saying is, can you send us somebody to preach the gospel to us? So Psalms and isolation are our next heading. Staying the same in a changing world. The next thing after that, number three, is Christ is King. Colon. But over whom and how? Christ is King. That is not a negotiable distinctive. But over whom and how is? Christ is King and head of his church. That is something that every one of the denominations that our congregations have ever been in has held as a fixed. It's the reason that most of them came into being, was that Christ is King and head of his church. The secession churches in Scotland, the Free Church in Scotland, these are churches that are set on this, that the Christ is King and head of his church. But the Covenanters have something more than that. They have that Christ is King and head of the nations. And the secession people and the Free Church people would also say, true, this is very true. But the Covenanters say, but he is King and head of the nations as mediator. And the secession churches and the Free Church says, no. He is King and head of the nations as Son of God. If you want to read up about this, you find the testimony of the secession church written by Adam Gibb, and he takes Mr. Nairn and is not kind towards him in his writing. What happened was that Mr. Nairn changed his view from the secession church view to the covenanter view and left. And his leaving the secession church and going to the covenanters allowed them to have two ministers. And that was when they reformed their presbytery. The Reformed Presbyterians are not called Reformed because of their theology. They are the Reformed Presbytery because Nairn and Macmillan got together and they had two ministers and a ruling elder and they could form their presbytery again. So it's the Reformed Presbytery. But the churches that we are made up of have both of these views. Of Christ the King with regard to the nations. So we do not have a distinctive on that. We do have the distinctive that we firmly believe that Jesus Christ is King and head of his church. We believe that Jesus Christ is King and head of the nations. But it's up to the individual to explain that either in terms of his being the Son of God or of it being a mediatorial, a kingship. So we have distinctives, but we have places in our distinctives where there is liberty. And that brings me to our next one. Number four, authority and limits. Number four, authority and limits. One of the things that has marked out the history of our denomination is authority. But at every stage, there has also been the idea of limited authority. The congregations left the churches, and the stated reason is usually matters of worship, moving away from the old paths of psalmody and no instrumental music and simplicity. But there were other things that were stated at times. And those things brought a reaction out of the churches, the people that we are the descendants of. That is, when a church court made a ruling that was beyond Scripture. When the church courts, for example, in the 19th century, embraced temperance and made it a condition of membership, they would not accept it. That was one of the issues with the United Presbyterian Church of North America, was the fact that they were adding things to the list of qualifications for membership that were not in the Scriptures. A credible profession of faith. That's all the Scriptures require, a credible profession of faith. To add other conditions to that, our forebears said no. You remember last night, Mr. Myers spoke of the Reverend Matheson's challenging the prohibitionist instruction from the Free Presbyterian Synod. It was on that basis. These were things that alarmed our people. The fact that a church body could add unscriptural things to the conditions for church membership. Not that these things were not scriptural in themselves. Everybody has the right to decide for themselves in their own mind from the reading of Scripture whether or not they would use alcohol, whether or not they would use tobacco, whether they would have in their home a television, or whatever that would be. Everyone has the freedom to do that. You can say, I don't want to have one. Well, good. And the person says, well, I'm going to have one, but I'm going to limit it in this way. And you say, that's fine. What you can't do is say, well, because you have a television, you can't be a member in our church. Or because you don't have a television, you're such a fuddy-duddy, we don't want you in our fellowship. You can't do that among us. That is one of our distinctives. Keeping your nose out of other people's business is one of our denominational distinctives. Authority and limits. And the right of private judgment and liberty of conscience. There are a number of correct answers to the questions. Fifthly, I have a question. Where have all the adherents gone? Where have all the adherents gone? Now, a long time passing. Where have they gone? You're going to say to me, what's an adherent? And I'm going to say to you, you don't know what an adherent is. Allow me to explain. An adherent is a non-baptized member of the congregation. That's what they were called. You know, members were communicant members, and adherents were non-communicant members. The baptized within the congregation who have not made a profession of faith. In the olden days, because of our secession and free church background, and because that free church background was predominantly Highland, the immigrants were Highlanders, and their leaders were two men. One was called John Ross of Brucefield, the other one was called Lachlan McPherson of East Williams. And those two men came over from Scotland. They kept their churches out of the unions, and they kept to the old paths. But that meant that they still followed their old ways with regard to the patterns of church life. And it was out of their ministry and culture and history that Mr. Matheson came. And Mr. Matheson looms large over our history. He was the minister in Chesley. He lived in Chesley. He served the Chesley congregation, the Lochalsh congregation, and he went down for whole months in the summers to East Williams before the church was taken away to the park to supply down there. He came out of not the Chesley church, not the Toronto church, but these churches that were so much a part of us but have gone, but have left their mark. And I ask the question, where have all the adherents gone? Because their style of preaching was a style of preaching which made the making of a profession of faith something to be very seriously considered. And so there would be many adults in the congregation who were baptized there every week but had not made a profession of faith. And our times have changed. We've changed from that. And it happened, first of all, in the 60s. When John Murray was working with the congregations, he brought his view of baptism, which was not the Highland view, even though he was a Highland man himself. He had changed his mind and had a different view of baptism that went back in the old, through the history of the Presbyterian Church. There's always been a question on this. Do you follow Rutherford or Boston? Do you follow Kennedy or Cunningham? Well, for us, it was, do you follow Matheson or Murray? And for a number of years, that question so vexed that there were no baptisms. There's a man my age in the congregation, and he remembers his baptism because he was three. Because there was this time where there was no baptisms because the sessions couldn't agree which view to take. Till they eventually came to the point that they took more or less the Boston, Cunningham, Murray line. But that meant that people made their profession of faith during a pregnancy, because the people would come and make a profession of faith when they knew that they were going to need a baptism. That was that change. And that continued for a while. Reading through the session book, you're going, oh, that's when so-and-so made a profession of faith. Oh, and that's when Thingy was born. No, that's what the pattern changed to. Nowadays in our churches, the pattern has changed again. And we have many more young people making their profession of faith at a time when they have come to an understanding of the truth and when they have made their close with Christ. They're making their profession of faith. In the olden days, people would make their close with Christ, but they would wait a long time before they made their profession of faith. But now we have many more young people sitting at the Lord's table than we've ever had in the history of the church before. Where have all the adherents gone? Well, there are changes in the patterns of making profession of faith. But there is something that we have lost in the change. And that is that old care. That is that seriousness. I am not saying that our young people, when they come forward to the Lord's table, are not serious. I know they are. But there is something that we have to remember. The language that was used in the olden days to encourage a profession of faith is language that we still have to use to our young communicants, that they be grounded in the faith and that they're still considering Christ and that they're still considering the relationship to Him and with Him. Making a profession of faith is always a beginning. It's not a sign of having arrived. So if I'd like to make that our fifth distinctive. Making a profession of faith is a beginning. It's not having arrived. It's not, I was unconverted, I've made my profession of faith, I'm now a believer. Nothing wrong with that. But the question is this. Well, professing person, how are you today? I don't want to hear your testimony of when you were converted. I want to hear your testimony of yesterday. I want to hear of your hope for tomorrow. And that is one of our distinctives, one of the elements of our preaching. Another distinctive that we have, and again I've phrased this in terms of a slight paradox. An interesting form of words. I'm not going to use words like paradox when there's philosophers in the building. I cut the word necessary out of my vocabulary when I was ever talking to Dr. Young. The free offer and closed communion. The free offer and closed communion. That's number six. We, as a denomination, have always held to the free offer of the gospel. Every body that we have ever belonged to was a free offer of the gospel body. The secession churches, free offer of the gospel. The same Gibb that was chewing out Mr. Nairn was defending at length and vocally with the same vehemence the free offer of the gospel. If you're reading church history of the secession times, there's one thing that you learn very quickly. If you're going to pick a fight, you don't do it with Adam Gibb. The free offer of the gospel. But on the other hand, still part of that secession heritage and part of that Free Presbyterian Church of Scotland heritage, free offer of the gospel, closed communion. That is, only members of the denomination can come to the table in the denomination. There are no visiting places, no tokens for visitors to come to the Lord's table. Closed communion and the free offer. Do you know what that does? It means that you preach very, very warmly to people in church. And the vast majority out there never hear. It's a problem. Free offer and closed communion. We hold to the free offer of the gospel. We used to hold to closed communion. Now we hold to what is called restricted communion. I don't like these terms. I'm only using them because other people do. And once people start using words, you kind of have to follow along just to be understood. What do we have? We have restricted communion. That means that our communion table is open to any believer in the Lord Jesus Christ who has made a profession of faith in a church where there is a leadership who have judged and accepted that profession of faith. But we also do this. We don't just say, come on down. We say, if you're going to come and have communion with us today, or if they're coming in at the door, you say, excuse me, well, we're having communion today. Are you a member of a church? Would you please speak with the session for a few minutes if you want to come to the table? Just so that we know who you are, where you've come from, that you are a member in good standing in a church that preaches the gospel. Because we want the Lord's people to gather around the table with the Lord's people. We don't want to say, stranger, we don't know you, stay away. Christ has some very serious things to say about that sort of attitude. But we do have a responsibility of care. And so that's how we work these two things together. Not a blanket no, not a complete come on down, but a careful approach. And as we do that, we can only hope that we are getting to the stage where we freely offer Christ to people who haven't made it into the doors of our buildings. Another thing under the free offer and closed communion is that necessity is the mother of ecumenism. Necessity is the mother of ecumenism. What do I mean by that? Over the years, when we've had difficulties, we've had not enough ministers, we haven't been able to constitute courts yet, we've needed to do things, people have come and helped us. Brian Myers told us last night of John Murray and of Dr. Freeman and Dr. Young. Well, there were others who were involved as well. Reverend John McSween of the Free Church, who pastored an immigrant congregation in Toronto, but came over to help the indigenous congregation in the place. And if he were still available to question, if you asked Dr. Young, who the greatest preacher, Mirror Mirror on the Wall, who's the greatest preacher of them all, it would be John McSween would be his answer. John McSween had a philosophical frame of mind which gave them a great attraction. But John McSween was also a man who preached very much experimental Calvinism. And John McSween was one who came. Another was John MacLeod. Again, Free Church minister there. When we were in dire straits, It was two Free Church ministers, Donald McClure and William Underhay, who came in and ordained Finlay McCormick when there were no other ministers around. They came in and they helped. So necessity became the mother of ecumenism. Even though we'd spent all of that time being isolated, well, you can be isolated when you're self-sufficient, but when you need help, you can't be so proud. And out of that came an acceptance of help and the fact that we're not the only true church. So even though there was this closed communion background, even though there is this psalmody and isolation, even though there is indigenization without assimilation, there is still the recognition that we are part of something bigger. Our forebears used a term with regard to the worship. They said they worked in terms of more or less pure. Churches were more or less pure. The worship was more or less pure. We don't have a true and a false church history. And we shouldn't have a true and false church mentality. Just because someone does something not as we would like it doesn't mean that they're not Christians. Doesn't mean that they're not people with whom we would have fellowship. So that crosses national and racial boundaries. It reminds us that one of the great problems of theological distinctives is that massive overriding theological distinctive that they bring, and that is spiritual pride. And we must remember necessity, the mother of ecumenism, the times when we had nothing and we had to go and ask for help. No place for spiritual pride. Lastly, number 7. If your notes are as clearly organized as mine, we have the free offer and self-examination. We can't leave this subject of our theological distinctives without a reference to John Murray. And so I do so. In his collected writings, volume 1, The Claims of Truth, he has a speech that was given to alumni of Westminster Theological Seminary at their annual homecoming on February 19, 1952. And the subject is some necessary emphasis in preaching. The first one that he has is the ministry of judgment, preaching the law. The second one he has is the free offer of the gospel. The third one he has is self-examination. The free offer and self-examination. If we can hold those two things together, we have our heritage in the gospel that we preach. A freely offered Christ. And a question. Is he your Saviour? Are you his? The subheadings of this one are that we must never take our salvation for granted. You made a profession of faith. You must never take it for granted. Number 2, that it is a responsibility to question. It is a responsibility to test, to try, to make our calling and election sure. And thirdly, it is not correct. It is not sufficient that members of the church should be true believers and the heirs of eternal life, but it's also necessary that they be self-consciously and intelligently so. It is right to question, but it's wrong to question interminably. A question has to have an answer. So, self-examination. Remember the example in, with regard to the Lord's table? Let a man examine himself, and so let him eat. Let a man examine himself with regard to his calling and election, and so let him be assured. So let him rest in hope. These, I believe, these seven things are the theological distinctives of the Presbyterian Reformed Church. We are a North American church. We have been a North American church off and on for a long time. Strangely enough, that border was a border that was fixed for an awful lot of things, but when it came to the smaller Presbyterian bodies, they always ended up being of North America. The Scottish Reformed Presbyterians presbytery in the Maritime Provinces, and the Irish Presbyterian Reformed Presbyterian presbytery in the Maritime Provinces, never, of course, joined together themselves, but they did join together separately into the Reformed Presbyterian Church of America that became the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America at their joining. We've been part of the North American United Presbyterian Church, the Associate Presbyterian Church that had church congregations in the Midwest. That line, that border has never been particularly important to it. We are a North American church, but we're not doing things in the general, usual North American way, number one. Number two, we stand for a particular form of worship, and that has meant separation. It's meant a measure of isolation, but it's not an option for change. Christ is King and Head of His Church. We are firmly committed to that. Christ, King and Head of the Nations, we are firmly committed to that. How you as an individual argue for that, how you understand it, that's up to you. But Christ is King. There is authority in the church, and there are limits to that authority. We hold to liberty of conscience. We believe very firmly that the time of your conversion is the beginning of something, it's not the end. We hold to the free offer, but we restrict communion. We hold to the free offer and preach self-examination. And written above all of them, if we fall into spiritual pride, then the glory has departed, and we have no right to expect the candlestick to remain. Thank you for listening for so long.